This is Peter Stanford and his daughter Orla, who's very kindly come up to talk to us about journalism, and Peter obviously is a journalist. He was just asking me, did he have to stand here or did he have to go up to the high board? So I said, you don't have to go up and do a pirouette up there, so he was all right. But we're very fortunate to have Peter here. I know him, as you may know, from St. Henry Walpole's church in Burnham Market. He comes up here to, in theory, have a rest, get away from his busy life in London. But just let me tell you a few of the things that he's achieved. He's been an author of several biographies. You may have seen the Lord Longford biography, which was serialised on Channel 4 in 2006, and I gather was a multi-award winning drama. He's also done biographies of Cardinal Hume, C. Day Lewis, and he's written several other books, including one on the devil and one on heaven, which he was signing when I walked in, actually, a copy of. He was editor of the Catholic Herald between 1988 and 1992, and he now writes for the Daily Telegraph. I've seen a few of his articles very recently, actually, The Independent and The Observer. He presents on television and radio, documentaries, and has been a regular panellist on The Moral Maze on the radio. He's also chairman of a spinal injuries charity called Aspire for 20 years, which I think he's now stopped doing, and he's director of the Longford Trust for Penal Reform. So thank you very much, Peter, for coming up and talking to us about journalism, whether it's a vice or whether it's a virtue. Thanks a lot.
You may decide at the end that that you think it's a vice and I think it's a virtue, but I'm certainly not pretending to be virtuous at all, and certainly wouldn't want to stand up in there and claim any sort of virtue at all. I really wanted to, when Peter suggested talking, obviously the Leveson inquiry is on at the moment, and there are all sorts of terrible things that you've read about what goes on in newspapers. In the press, and clearly these things do go on. I just really wanted to talk to you from the perspective of someone. I mean, I sort of dip in and out of journalism in a way, in that obviously years ago I used to run a small religious newspaper, and since that time I started off by deciding I was going to write books and lock myself away in an ivory tower, but unfortunately not enough people bought the books for me to lock myself away in the ivory tower, so I had to descend from the heights to Grub Street. So at different stages I've worked for different newspapers, nearly always in a freelance capacity, and nearly always doing things like features and reviews and those things. I've never, I'm pleased to say, and I'm sure you'll be pleased here, I've never been one of those journalists who chases people around in cars and puts my foot in the front door and does all of those things, and I've never paid anyone for their story in that sense. I'll start off with a kind of caveat on all of that. So I'm probably going to give you a slightly sanitised version of it all. But anyway, thinking about the title, it's always very good when people ask you to come up with titles 6 months in advance, because you come up rather glibly and say, oh, Vice or Virtue. There used to be a series on Radio 4 called Vice or Virtue, which was the gentler version of The Moral Maze, because Peter mentioned very kindly that I used to be a panellist on The Moral Maze. I got sacked from The Moral Maze because I wasn't argumentative enough, which obviously isn't a good way. And I committed the terrible sin one week. The producer took me to one side at the end of the series and said, look, what you mustn't keep doing is changing your mind when you listen to... Because you know the idea was you have all these witnesses who come in and you're meant to listen to them really carefully. And I just thought you listened to them carefully and then you changed your mind if they said something really intelligent. And they got really cross with me and said, stop changing your mind. So they then relegated me to a series called Vice or Virtue, which was meant to be a gentler version where you were allowed to change your mind. But obviously people didn't want to listen to that because it got axed. But anyway, Vice or Virtue. So I came up with Vice or Virtue. But this morning when I was, just by chance, I was thinking about... about journalism, and particularly what's been coming up in the press recently or in public debate is, you know, what is the point of journalism if this is, if we're all running around hacking people's phones and chasing around after celebrities and basically sort of debasing the kind of morality of the country. And there were two stories, just by chance. My wife had to go back to London, so got up very early, so I ended up by listening to the Today programme from a very early stage this morning. I listened to it all the way through, so I had the sports news three times, which is always a bonus. But there were two stories, I don't know if anyone else was listening this morning, both of which, it seemed to me, were investigative journalism at its best. So first of all, there was the story, I don't know whether you heard this particular bit, about the young man who had helped the police with their inquiries about a gangland attack in London, and the police and the Crown Prosecution Service had managed inadvertently to give away his details to the people who he was giving evidence against. So he and his family have now had to move and change identities and move literally at the drop of a hat. And that only became, that happened 4 or 5 years ago, and only became apparent because of investigative journalism. What normally happens in these cases is that people are compensated for the destruction of their lives, frankly. How do you compensate someone for destroying their lives? But they're given compensation, but part of the deal is they have to, in order to get the financial compensation, they have to sign a clause saying they'll never talk to anyone about it. So these things are brushed under the carpet. And the investigative journalists at the BBC had brought that forward. And I think we all need to know that, really. We need to know, because sometimes you do think, you know, my son's just arrived as well. If you have young children living in a city and you worry about all these things that go on, and you think, well, why don't people come forward? You know, the people that I meet in the street all seem pretty decent people who would tell you if these things are going on, who would automatically go to the police. Why don't people come forward? Well, you know, here's a really good reason why people don't come forward. And we would never have heard of that but for that. And the other story, the digital radio. You know, we're all meant to have digital radios now, because digital radio is so good. The digital radio doesn't work at all in our cottage. There appears to be no signal at all. So we have to listen to Radio 4 on long wave, and at 8:30 you suddenly flip over to Yesterday in Parliament, which can sometimes be less interesting than it might be. But they started off with a story, a debate at the beginning of the day in the House of Lords about honour killings. And again, this was all based on investigative journalism. Investigative journalists had gone out and was looking at how the much better regulation that we've now put into place in this country in terms of trying to stop this happening really isn't working as effectively as it could. And because of those reports that the journalists had written, they were now having debate in the House of Lords about it, and the Home Office Minister was answering, and those thoughts were going back, which again, I hope we would all agree is a good thing, that process works in that way. And indeed, in the Guardian today, there was a story about human trafficking in the Sinai Peninsula. I don't know if anyone saw this. I mean, just such a gruesome and ghastly story about people from Eritrea and Somalia, principally, who were walking, basically. They were paying human smugglers £3,000, $3,000, and they were thinking they were going to be led through the Sinai Desert, rather appropriate in reading through the Sinai Desert, to Israel, to the promised land in that sense, where they were going to find work. And then they were being held in the Sinai Desert by these people smugglers, people traffickers, who then started ringing their relatives and saying that unless they paid them more money, they would sort of hold them prisoner, torture them, abuse them, or whatever. I mean, again, that someone is bringing that story to our attention. How would we know about that? And it's, you know, and it's just important that we know those things. So lots of... I'm starting off with a plea for the virtues of journalism in terms of investigative journalism. And I just, again, as I was gathering my thoughts today, I'm sure we could all think of examples, good examples of investigative journalism. I mean, the ones that easily trip off my tongue, and they become quite interesting in debating points, so apologies for the list. But the thalidomide scandal... that was all exposed by the Sunday Times Insight team. You might notice the Sunday Times doesn't particularly have an Insight team anymore, so investigative journalism is being wound down in that sense, but that was important. A chap called Seymour Hersh, he was the person who brought the My Lai massacre to our attention in Vietnam in 1970. That would have all been covered up, we would never have heard of that. And then again in 2004, so rather a distinguished career, 34 years on, he brought to our attention what was going on in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. So again, I think, you know, powerful, important things. The Watergate scandal. Bernstein and Woodward, you know, investigators and reporters, bringing us MPs' expenses, bringing it a bit more up to date and more recent. That was the Daily Telegraph brought those things out, brought all those details. So we would never have known. I mean, the parliamentary authorities did absolutely everything in their power to make sure we would never know those things. And I can't remember what their excuse was why we shouldn't know about them. But it really wasn't a very good excuse, whatever it was. And those things were brought to our attention. And the other one I thought was just worth mentioning is John Pilger, who brought the whole thing that went on in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge to our attention. I mean, not in the Financial Times or The Economist or The Times or The Guardian or any of those papers, but in the Daily Mirror. John Pilger always wrote his exposés in the Daily Mirror, when we tend to associate the Daily Mirror and the Red Tops more with a different sort of expose. But it's worth remembering that very recent and rather noble tradition. And of course, the other story that came to our attention through investigative journalism was the phone hacking scandal. It was Nick Davis in The Guardian who brought that to our attention. And I must admit, during the build-up to that, because that went on, The Guardian kept chiselling away and chiselling away at that story for about a year, and you thought, oh, for goodness sake, it may be interesting to journalists to know that other journalists don't always behave well, but I don't think anyone was particularly interested or as interested as The Guardian, but actually it brought you somewhere in the end, and he was the one who revealed what had happened to Millie Dowler and her parents in that. So there's investigative journalism. There's the case for, there's the virtuous bit of journalism. Those things are very important. Interestingly, if you start thinking about those cases that I've just talked about, you get into some pretty ropey areas, some rather dubious methods there. The reason the Daily Telegraph was able to expose what MPs were doing with their expenses was because they bought a disc from a disgruntled, I think it had been passed by a disgruntled employee to someone else, so they paid for stolen property. In its simplest, we're standing opposite the police station, so we better call a spade a spade. They paid for stolen property. I think if you'd asked us in the abstract whether they should do that, I'm sure all of us would balk at paying for stolen property. That's effectively what they did. I mean, they rather shilly-shally round that. I feel rather nervous of saying that since I worked them quite a lot of the time. But that's effectively what they did. But to a greater they would say the end justified the means. So again, I think when we're thinking about journalistic ethics, we have to think that it isn't always that clear cut. And of course, Bernstein and Woodward. I've got all their information about the Watergate scandal from Deep Throat, the source they called Deep Throat, and carried on calling Deep Throat until 2005, when they finally revealed it was the deputy director of the FBI at the time, whose name I've slightly forgotten. But actually, the next time a journalist says, oh, you know, I'll protect my sources, yeah, I really won't reveal your details if you tell me this. I mean, I'm sure our instinct would be not to trust them, but there's someone whose identity wasn't revealed for 40 years. They kept their promise in that sense. And we have, in recent times, had notable examples of journalists who were willing to go to prison rather than reveal their sources. So, you know, we're not such a bad bunch in that sense. Interesting, the leak culture, that thing of kind of leaking information, which of course is what Deep Throat was doing. I think we have rather contradictory reactions to that sometimes. Again, thinking about the ethics, thinking about the vices and virtues of it all. I don't know if any of you remember the name of Sarah Tisdall, who was the Foreign Office civil servant in the early 1980s, who leaked the details of the deployment of cruise missiles. At Greenham Common in 1983, and obviously led to the whole setting up of the camps there at Greenham Common in those days. Sarah Tisdall became a bit of a... She was sent to prison for doing that, but she became a bit of a cause célèbre. I think she became vice president of the Liberal Democrats at one stage. And everyone basically thought she'd done a really good thing by doing that. So that's the leaker as hero in that sense. But of course, every time you hear a leak now... I obviously listen to the Today programme too often, but the government minister will come on and they'll question them about some leaked bit of information, and they'll very pompously say, well, I never respond to leaks. We make it a policy of never responding to leaks. And of course then they call in the opposition, the shadow cabinet minister against them, who responds to it very, very, very fulsomely. And of course all our current government ministers responded very fulsomely before 2010 to leaked information. But now they're in power, they said rather pompously to say, oh no, I don't respond to leaked information. And one has to rather... That seems to me a rather portable set of ethics from one place to the other. And, of course, what makes it even more absurd in many ways is that where do some of these leaks come from? Leaks come from government ministers, from government departments. They have this... They play this game now where when they're thinking about an unpopular policy, and obviously they've got plenty at the moment, but when they're thinking about, well, could we do something very, very radical that people wouldn't privatise the BBC, for example, and one of them will have a nice chat, usually with a Sunday newspaper journalist, because on Sundays the assumption is that we read our papers rather more carefully. They'll have a chat with them, and on the front page of your Sunday Times or Sunday Telegraph, it'll be, you know, sources say, insiders, friends of the culture secretary tell us that, you know, that the moves are underfoot to privatise the BBC, and then they wait and see how big a response to that, how big a public outcry there is to that, and then they make a judgment as to whether they go ahead. So they're testing the water. So the next time you hear a government minister saying, I never respond to leaks, just bear in mind they've probably done quite a few themselves in the first place. So there's a degree of hypocrisy around all of this. I mean, sorry if this sounds like I'm shifting the blame, but I just think we need a kind of fuller picture where all of this goes. So, I mean, it clearly is in some... There is a game going on. But before... actually, we don't need that. Yes, I should have said this before. Just back on the investigative journalist point. I don't quite know why this came in the wrong place in my notes. But just as well, thinking about investigative journalists and the things that they do. Just a few names. Veronica Guerin. Does anyone remember Veronica Guerin? An Irish newspaper reporter in the 1990s who reported criminal activity there and was murdered, was shot in her car at the traffic lights. And there was a great film with Cate Blanchett in it as Veronica Guerin. And the Irish government afterwards set up a special branch of the Gardaí to look at the criminal underworld. So in that sense, her death wasn't in vain, although I don't wonder what her children would think about that. I'll have to look carefully at this in the light. Anna Polyakovska, who was the Russian journalist who was murdered in 2006. She was the person who exposed a lot of what the Russian authorities have been doing in Chechnya in the 1990s, and then exposed a lot of Putin's corruption. That's why there are all these marches at the moment, people refusing to accept it. She was murdered for doing that. And obviously they're very high-profile cases. But there was one other thing that, again, when I was thinking about this morning, there's an organisation in New York that protects the kind of freedom of journalists. And then one of their reports for 2011 was that in Brazil, and of course we all think Brazil's great now, and Brazil's the kind of rising economic power, so ministers are all flooding over to Brazil to embrace the Brazilians and tell them they love them, and, you know, we want to work as closely as possible, and could they buy some kind of military hardware from us, possibly, or something. In 2011, six journalists in Brazil were murdered, and all of them in different stages trying to expose government corruption, either at the national level or at regional level there. Six of them were killed. These things happen, so yes. So investigative journalists, it's... I've got my notes all in the wrong order now. Yes, anyway, let's get the notes. I'll try and remember what I was going to say. I think if you look at those journalists who died for what they were doing, I suppose one phrase that sometimes comes up, and it certainly came up in the Veronica Guerin film, was that she was a kind of martyr for the truth. I'm slightly nervous about the word martyr, because often that comes in a kind of religious context. And I do think as well, the other thing, these are all in a way kind of framing the debate. We ought to think what we mean by truth as well, what exactly we mean by truth. We're here in a Methodist chapel, and we're all church people in that sense. So we think of truth in religious terms, certainly. But I'm always quite nervous when people start banding the word truth around. And I suppose one of the things that brought it home is, Peter mentioned some of the biographies that I've written. When you're actually working with a biography subject's family, and you start talking about particular instances, everybody remembers it in a different way. And so what's true? What is true or what isn't true? How do you judge somebody's motives afterwards? Often, you know, we all know ourselves, we do things. We have very, very mixed motives sometimes as to why we're doing things. And I just think we have to be, if we think journalism should be in pursuit of truth, I think we just have to be slightly careful as to what precisely truth means. Because one man's truth is another man's distortion. These things are fairly fluid concepts, certainly in terms of reporting kind of information. I mentioned at the beginning the Leveson inquiry, the phone hacking, that all of those things, and I think the backdrop to that, really, we have to think how we got to where we've got to now. It seems to me that two rights are coming into conflict there. The idea of freedom of the press, which we hold relatively dear, and also the idea of that we all have a right to privacy. This is enshrined in the European Convention on Human Rights. I think it's Article 8, that we all have the right to a family life and privacy. And it's being used very much at the moment against freedom of the press. The two things that come into conflict. And actually, again, framing it in a bigger sense, we're living in our society at the moment, we're living in a whole series of conflicting rights. And one of the jobs I did for The Telegraph last week was into George Carey, who's just published this book called We Don't Do God. And what he's talking about very articulately, very very eloquently in that, is this clash of rights that goes on between equality, between fundamental ideas of equality, and between freedom of religion, their freedom to speak of their religious views and to act on their religious beliefs. And there have been a number of cases, the Biddeford Town Council, the couple who turned the gay couple away from their B&B, the woman who, the registrar in Islington, who didn't want to register civil partnerships, the woman who wore the cross at British Airways, the British Airways check-in people, a whole series of things where, the idea that people might take offence, that it might offend our ideas that each of us are fundamentally equal as human beings, are weighed against religious rights. So there's a lot of this kind of weighing of different things going on at the moment, and actually George Carey would say, and I've got quite a lot of sympathy with the view, that religious rights are always put rather lower than the rights of equality. But anyway, let's think of that freedom of the press against the right to privacy. When we think what democracy is based on, and we pride ourselves in living in a democracy, Parliament is the mother of parliaments, and we seem to intervene in countries around the world to try and encourage them to bring democracy. What's democracy based on? It's based on several things. It's based on freedom of the press, it's based on universal suffrage, it's based on the rule of law, and it's based on free speech. They're the bedrocks, the pillars, like these pillars holding up the balcony here. They're the pillars of democracy, of the kind of, an ideal of society as we can have. But interestingly, if you start thinking about some of those other ones, we accept limits on them all. We seem fairly readily to accept limits. So if you think about the rule of law and the importance of the rule of law, and that should never be compromised, I'm afraid you have to start thinking about Abu Qatada, who was locked up for 6 years. He's never been charged with anything, but he was held in prison. I mean, however repugnant his views are, this man was held in prison for 6 years. That's a very long time to hold someone in prison without charging them, innocent until proved guilty, and all those basic principles of law. And that's all to do with this raft of terrorism legislation that we've had over the last 10 years or so. And that has compromised the rule of law. That's impinged on some of those fundamental freedoms there. And again, you can see it in the case of America as well. It enshrines all these freedoms in its constitution, but carries on running Guantanamo Bay. 4 years ago, Barack Obama was elected telling us he was going to get rid of Guantanamo Bay. He was going to close it for all the very obvious reasons that it offended against these principles of the rule of law, and it's still there. So we can accept restrictions on that. We can debate them, but we can accept them. Freedom of speech. We accept restrictions on freedom of speech now. We don't accept that it's perfectly all right for someone to attack someone's religious beliefs. Very, very strongly. There's legislation now that limits freedom of speech. So there's a case recently of three Muslim men up in Derbyshire who'd been handing out leaflets that carried a very homophobic message, and they were charged, and actually they've been sent to prison for that. So we accept that there are limits on freedom of speech, and I'm afraid even on the suffrage, on the universal suffrage, we seem to accept there are limits. I don't think we should, but I think we do. And prisoners being the obvious example. But David Cameron, what did he say in Parliament? He said that it made him physically sick that the European Court had said that prisoners should have the right to vote. There are an awful lot of things in society that one might hope might make the Prime Minister physically sick. But the idea that prisoners who are being punished already, and query, should we add an extra punishment on that, that made him physically sick, I thought was an extraordinary thing. But we do accept, again, we accept these limitations. So my point really is, why shouldn't we accept that there can be limitations on the freedom of the press? Because a lot of what you've heard at the Leveson inquiry are particularly newspaper proprietors, newspaper owners, newspaper journalists standing up and saying, you know, once you start impinging at all on the freedom of the press, the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. Frankly, I think that's nonsense. I think those other examples of law, speech and suffrage show that we can run a fairly decent, tolerant society where people are held to account and with some sort of necessary accommodation. So yes, the freedom of the press should operate within limits. I'm absolutely in favour of that. The question is how exactly to do that. It's a pretty hard question, really, isn't it? It's hard for all sorts of reasons. It's hard because it offends against the fundamental ideas we have of ourselves. It's hard because the press put up such a good case against it. It's hard now as well because the outlets for the media are so hard to control. I mean, we have newspapers which are relatively easy to control because they're there and they have a proprietor. But, you know, we now have the internet where things pop up everywhere. So, you know, Ryan Giggs took out his libel case, his super injunction, paid some lawyer an absolute fortune to take out a super injunction. And frankly, all we had to do was type into Google, footballer, silent thing, super injunction, and up came Ryan Giggs. Everybody knew it. There's absolutely nothing he could do about that. So in terms of kind of limiting what people can say, I wonder how many of us, I'm almost ashamed to admit this, but when the Andrew Marr story broke about Andrew Marr, there was some great fuss in the papers about Andrew Marr had been having an affair with another journalist. And idle curiosity one day, I just sat there and I tapped his name in, just because I sort of wanted to know who the other person, I mean, probably out of curiosity, perhaps it was someone I worked with or whatever, but I'm apologising for it, but idle curiosity, all these things are possible now with the internet. So how exactly, you know, if you're going to start legislating, how do you do that? And I suppose in the end, in the past, we would have said it was down to libel laws, but they don't work anymore. You can spend hundreds of thousands of pounds and everyone will still know. It's where do you get there? Another thing I think that makes it very hard is that sense of it all having become a game. That whole relationship between the press, between politicians, between celebrities, between the press and society, having become a game where people are playing for advantage all the time. I mean, at its simplest, a kind of public relations game. And I sort of lost count of the number of people when you're sent along to interview them by newspapers. I mean, I always think there are people fall into two categories when you go and interview them. There are the ones who don't particularly want to be interviewed, and you end up by persuading them, often someone who's got a very interesting point of view on something. I mean, you know, you would never force someone, but if they've got something that might illustrate a contemporary dilemma we have. So they haven't sought you out, you've sought them out. And I think that there's one set of rules for that, and I think you have to treat people very, very carefully and cautiously around that. But when people seek you out, and there's a whole industry of people kind of, you know, sort of saying, I'd make a good story. In the Telegraph, we do this Saturday news interview. And you're constantly getting people kind of saying, oh, so-and-so would make a good one for that. And you say, and who are you? And they go, I'm their press secretary. Or I'm the publisher of their new book. Or they're doing a new documentary for us. And I'm afraid, this isn't just mindless celebrities. This goes at all levels. So I was sent along recently to interview Vincent Nichols, the Archbishop of Westminster, who I'm very fond of and I think is a very good man in lots of ways. And he isn't the most interesting interviewee, it has to be said. He's very cautious about what he says. But halfway through he said, I'm sorry, I need to give you something new, don't I? So I the interview won't be interesting unless I say something new, unless I reveal some nugget of information. So the game is going on there between subject and interviewer, where we all play along with that. And it makes it very, very hard. There's a sort of cynicism in all of that. I mean, there's a cynicism awash in society anyway, and I think often the press ends up by reflecting society. And I think one of the big problems we have is this very, very profound cynicism. And you know, just a couple of examples that occurred to me when I was... they're drawn on personal experience. Apologies to any Daily Mail readers here, and I know it's very easy and very fashionable to bash the Daily Mail, and they do lots of good things in some ways. But I did write for the Daily Mail from time to time. Actually, one great thing about Daily Mail is they think religion is a wonderful thing. They can't have enough articles about faith and religion in a positive sense in the Daily Mail, so we should applaud them from that point of view. And of course, what does the Daily Mail do? It sells many, many copies. It is the newspaper that sells the most copies. So the newspaper that sells the most copies thinks that religion is interesting. What does that tell you about the population? I think it rather bears out those census figures that 70% of people have some sort of religious belief that Richard Dawkins is getting so upset about at the moment. But anyway. But so the Daily Mail, I've written a few pieces for them, and I was taken out to lunch by one of their the sort of bigwigs there, who told me that they play a game there on the comment desk, which is, so a story appears in the news, and they sit there and they think what they think about it. They work out what the angle should be on that. And sometimes it isn't a very nice or a very tolerant or a very Christian point of view on it all. And then they think about liberal journalists they can ring up. And so they ring around liberal journalists and say, would you write a comment piece for us on, I don't know, David Beckham's affair or whatever. And the liberal journalist will start off by saying, well, you know, I think, and the liberal journalist will say, I don't think it's a particularly important thing, I don't think we should get too worked up about this. And they say, oh, well, what we think at the Daily Mail is, we think it's all shocking and he should be hung, drawn and quartered, or whatever. And they say, but if you'll write 600 words for us, we'll pay you £1,000. And what this woman said to me, she said, it's extraordinary how the mighty fall. All these people, you see them on Question Time beating the table for liberal principles, and then when you actually offer them a sum of money, they will write that article. They'll hedge it around slightly, but they will write that article. Cynicism, kind of corruption, and you know, money in lots of ways, love of money. Corrupts, doesn't it? We're told. Again, the same woman then said to me, the editor likes you. He likes your writing on religious subjects. What else would you be interested in writing about? And I do quite a lot of work with CAFOD, the Overseas Development Agency, so I rather glibly said, oh, you know, I like going on trips with CAFOD and writing about those. You know, the only overseas stories we're interested in are terrorism or Spanish people abusing donkeys. We really don't do overseas stories apart from that. Sorry, if you're Spanish here, I apologise. There's that sort of cynical view around, and I'm just trying to kind of be honest about the world. And here's another example from very recently, and this is from the Daily Telegraph, which is nowhere near as cynical, I would say. But they sent me along to interview Annie Lennox, the singer, who was publicising a charity she's involved with called Mother to Mother, which supports mothers in South Africa who are HIV positive to help them during their pregnancy to take the appropriate medication not to pass the HIV virus onto their children. Entirely good thing. And that evening she was giving a concert where she literally just sat and played her piano. And she was lovely. She was, you know, however cynical you felt about it, she couldn't have been a nicer woman. She couldn't have been more honest, open, committed. She didn't have a row of minders come in after her. She just came in, we sat down, we did that thing that you often do where you sit on one chair and she sat on the other. And she said, oh, no, this is a bit formal. Come and sit next to me. So I ended up, obviously, I was being manipulated in that way. But anyway, so I came and sat next to her. Lovely. Wrote a piece about her. Said, I mean, and, you know, obviously the objection in those situations, the objection to all those people is, I think Annie Lennox is the 30th most wealthy woman in Britain. I can't remember how much the Sunday Times rich list say she has. So why don't they just give money to these things? Why do they have to be seen as... And so I asked her all those questions. She came up with very good answers for them. I wrote the piece, and the people on the features desk rang and said, oh, it's a really nice piece. We really like it. But you just make her sound nice. And I said, well, she was nice. She really was nice. And they said, the editor isn't really very keen on running things that tell you people are nice. And they said, isn't there anything you could say that just, like, took the niceness off? And I said, well, no. I just thought, actually, this is a, you know, moment has come to take us down. I said, no, there's nothing you can... I think her answers are very good answers to the difficult questions you could ask her. And they said, oh, well, leave it with us. And it hasn't... No one's ever told me it's not going to appear, but it hasn't appeared. It won't appear. People don't want to hear that. So there's cynicism as well. And you can slightly overstate that. And again, as a balancing example, one of the things the Daily Telegraph is very noted for is its climate change scepticism. It's pretty sceptical about climate change. And they'd organised an interview with a man called Rajendra Pachauri, who was head of the United Nations Climate Change Organisation, who were the ones who did... Do you remember they did that report that said the Himalayan glaciers were going to melt in 5 minutes? And they got all the details wrong. I'm exaggerating slightly, but they got the details wrong. And so the Telegraph's environment editor, who is pretty sceptical about all of these things, had basically spent ages organising this interview with him. And the idea was to hang this man out to dry, really, was what he wanted to do. Anyway, there is a God, because the man who was, Jeffrey, the environment editor, who was going to do it, was struck down with an illness that day and wasn't able to go. So they rang and said, oh, Peter, would you go? And I said, well, I really don't know a lot about climate change, but I'll go. And I went, actually, Ollie, you came with me, didn't you? Because it was in the school holidays. So we went down, and this man was absolutely charming. And he explained why this particular mistake had been made, and it was one paragraph in 36,000 paragraphs in the report, and the rest of it was all right. And it's an organisation with no resources. The UN give it no resources, and it's scientists all working together, doing their very best. And in 10 years, they've only made one mistake, so it doesn't make all the rest of it wrong. And I wrote that, and actually they published it. So, cynicism runs up to a certain point, but please don't believe, I'm giving you bad examples, but let me give you a good example as well. I have to tell you, what was absolutely revolting was the blogs underneath, the comments underneath. That people, there's something about that thing with the internet now, and people commenting on articles, that in the past, if you had to write a letter to the editor, and you had to kind of write it and put it in an envelope, address it and put it in the postbox, I think it gave you time just to think a little more charitably. Whereas if you just sit there and you read something and then you type it out and press the button, I mean, people say revolting things in those things. I interviewed two women recently who'd, one had worked in the city and one had worked in the food industry, and they set up a business called Wild at Heart, where they went and, what do you call it, not rummaging, when you go into the hedgerow, foraging, that's the word, and you get things, and it's cool, and they make these things like crab apple jelly, medlar jelly, and I wrote it in the weekend supplement on the food pages, all jolly, it was a picture of them, they're both perfectly nice, perfectly attractive women, and they rang me on the Saturday when it appeared and said, thank you, that's such a nice article, but we're just a bit upset about the comments underneath. And I said, oh, what comments? I opened my computer and looked, and underneath someone had said, I don't know about foraging in hedgerows to find things to make jelly with. These two women ought to forage to get something to make a face pack and make themselves more attractive. And that's the internet for you. It gives people license to say the most revolting things. And actually, I think there's a bigger point here about media. When we worry why the media says such revolting things, I think we also have to think that we buy it, and that there's some sort of rather unpleasant relationship going on there. How did I get onto that? I was talking about good examples and bad examples. Okay, celebrities. We ought to just get onto this celebrity thing. I think the most honest thing a celebrity has ever said to me when I've been to interview them was Daniel Day-Lewis, who's Cecil Day-Lewis's son, strangely, who I wrote a biography of, it was when that film that he won an Oscar for, There Must Be Blood, There Will Be Blood, There Must Be Blood, whatever it's called, that one, came out, and the film company had great hopes that he was going to win an Oscar, so they browbeat him, basically, into giving interviews, and he really didn't want to do it, and one of their ways to browbeat him into giving an interview was they said, well, why don't we get the journalist who wrote your dad's biography to fly over to Ireland to come and interview, because you trust him, because he was nice about your dad and whatever. So over I went, and as he opened the door, Daniel said, I really don't like giving interviews. And I said, oh, sorry, shouldn't really be here. And he said, you know, the thing about it is, if you're an actor, as soon as they know what colour your socks are in real life, that gets in the way of them believing you are whoever you are when you're a character. The whole thing about being an actor is people should know nothing about you, because you must just be a blank canvas who then becomes that person, and the way, you know, Meryl Streep becomes Margaret Thatcher, and we shouldn't know any details. And actually, he's right. He's absolutely right. So we shouldn't want to know, you know, where he lives, what his wife's called, what his children do, whether he loved his dad or didn't love his dad. We shouldn't want to know those things, but of course we do. And they get in the way. Hugh Grant gave evidence at the Leveson Inquiry. I don't know if you saw those ones, where I thought this spoke rather honestly, where he said, I work on a film for 12 months, and a lot of money spent on it, a lot of people work on it, and one of the ways that it will be successful is people go and see it, and one of the reasons people will go and see it is because they know it's happening, and one of the ways they know it's going to happen is because I give interviews. So it's the game. You do it out of loyalty to the people you've worked for, the people who've backed it, and you give the interview, and they don't just want you to tell them the plot of the film, particularly if it's a thriller, because you'll end up by giving it away what happens, so they end up asking you a few questions about your life. And, you know, you sort of, you don't send in too intimate, but you say a few things about your life. And that really is often what those people do. And with most of these people, when you go and interview them, if you look at the cuttings, there are about three or four stories that they tell, that they regurgitate every time. It's almost like a record. And a film comes out every 12 months, they get asked the same question. So does he miss Liz Hurley? Does he wish he'd been a father? Whatever. They ask all the same questions. And it almost becomes, people have this sort of caricature of themselves that appears in the paper. And it's nothing to do with what they're like, really. But they play the game in that sense. And then Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, turned up at the Leveson Inquiry and said he'd take no lessons from Hugh Grant, who'd invaded his own privacy more time than any newspaper had. I don't think he's invaded his privacy. He's simply played a game where he's told a few anecdotes about himself. He hasn't bared his soul or, you know, revealed his inner angst in that sense. So I think you have to be, you know, when the justification for newspapers preying on celebrities is that they invade their own privacy all the time, then you have to make a judgment in that. And I think there certainly are people who live every single detail of their life out in public, but it's very few of them. It's not all of them. So this justification that somehow they asked for it, I think we just have to judge that. Think about the process where those interviews appear. You know, they're not kind of great bearings of the soul in that sense. I mean, obviously the other justification that's used for that is this public interest defence. But I thought Hugh Grant again spoke very well on that. He said, you know, I've never set myself up as a kind of paragon of virtue. I've never sort of preached morality to people. How could I, given what everyone knew about me? So, you know, where's the public interest in that? And I think the key difference in all this is between public interest and what interests the public. There's a world of difference between public interest and what interests the public. And that's one of the questions that it's always worth asking in all of that. So that's celebrities. Sorry, I'm going to have to put my glasses on now because I can't... And I think, even the most clear-sighted of people in all of this, I don't know if any of you read the papers on Monday about Adele, who's this extraordinary singer who's just won 6 Grammys in the United States and seems completely unchanged by her fame, doesn't play any sort of game. And in one of the interviews she gave afterwards, she said, you know, I just don't do personal stuff. You know, I won't play that game. I won't play the Hugh Grant game of giving you a few little tidbits about me so you'll write about me. You know, if you want to know that, don't bother writing about me. Write about my music. But then I thought, actually, what's her music about? And anyone who knows that this album, 21, it's all about, every single track on it is about her breakup with her boyfriend. So she's telling you in those songs the most intimate details about her life and then saying, don't ask me any details. I'm not being Paul Dacre. I'm not saying she's invaded her own privacy. But again, it's more complicated than this right to privacy. So I've got a right to privacy, and I'm going to sell millions and millions of records, not only because I'm incredibly talented and I have a wonderful voice and I'm wholly admirable, which she is, but also by bearing my soul. So where's the dividing line? We have to think carefully about that. And the other thing I was just going to add about celebrities, about the whole celebrity culture, is one of the other ways in which it corrupts and makes us cynical about things, I think, is that now it's very hard to write about anything that's really important without a celebrity getting involved. So Peter mentioned one of the things that I am involved with is Longford Trust, which work with prisoners. It's very, 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 very hard to let newspapers write about prison policy. They really don't want to know because they think readers don't want to know. But a couple of years ago, an organisation called Women in Prison called me and said, oh, look, we've got Michelle Collins, who used to be in EastEnders, you know the one? And her brother's just been sent to prison. She's very worked up about, her sister or cousin has been sent to prison. She's very worked up about all of these things. You know, could you do an interview where she doesn't want to talk about anything else other than prisons? And then newspapers all trip over themselves and say, yeah, we'd love to write prison, such an important subject, if a celebrity tells you it. So again, another light and shade in that equation. It isn't clear. It isn't absolutely straightforward in all of this. Just before we get on to what I think we could do about it, I think it's just necessary to say, in terms of the hacking of Millie Dowler's mobile phone and the way that her parents were treated, that's what's prompted the debate at the moment. There is absolutely no excuse for that whatsoever. And it's absolutely right that we are where we are on it. But all I wanted to say about that is, I sort of almost want to reassure you, I've never worked in a newspaper where people do that, or I've been aware of people doing that. I worked at The Independent for a while, where they're so prissy about morality there, that we'd get to a thing where you'd be sitting there and someone would sort of say, I'm doing a story about kind of historical biography and I want to ring Antonia Fraser. You've got her mobile phone number, haven't you? And I'd say, well, actually, no, I can't really give you her mobile phone number. I can send her an email and ask if I can give her mobile phone number. I mean, people follow I promise you, I mean, you can disbelieve me if you want, but that is routine in newspapers. You really, really don't do that. You don't hand people's details around about that. People are pretty ethical in that sense. Perhaps it's just in what we used to call the broadsheets. I've never been in a tabloid newspaper office. But I really don't want you to get this idea that I'm sort of putting up some great defence here, and actually, in reality, people are going around doing all these really appalling things. And in so much as the public believe that what happened to Lily Dowler's parents shouldn't be done in their name, I think the vast majority of journalists would say not in our name. We really wouldn't do it in all of that. Okay, so what next? Sorry, am I going on for too long? Gosh, I have gone on for ages. Let me just very quickly tell you what I think should happen next. One of the suggestions is a registration of journalists, that all journalists should be registered. Actually, years ago when I started, we all had to carry around an NUJ card, and no one ever asked me to show it. So that seemed a pretty pointless idea there. I mean, what are you going to do in registering journalists? We live in a global age. You're going to register British journalists? You're going to register all international journalists with an international passport? You're going to have people on the door checking before you go in to do an interview that you've got the right card? A newspaper's going to be banned from using you if you don't have the right card, like an equity card. I just can't quite see how that could possibly work. So I think that's a bit of a kind of non-runner, a non-starter. The Press Complaints Commission has clearly failed, absolutely, demonstrably failed, that idea of self-regulation. Newspapers at Daily Express walked away from it because it couldn't be bothered because it kept finding against it. So, you know, the idea that we can carry on with some sort of beefed-up form of self-regulation really isn't going to work at all. What was that phrase about they're in the last chance saloon? They've been in the last chance saloon so often, and these things go on, that I think no one has any faith in that. Another solution that's been put forward is the kind of the more statutory route along the lines of the BBC Trust, which has responsibility for editorial policy, and that is based in statute. There are teeth behind it, there's a legal force behind it, and that seems to be much more promising as a route. Although we have to be careful, the BBC and newspapers are not the same. We all pay a licence fee to the BBC, so everybody has a stake in the BBC. We don't all pay for newspapers. There's a difference between the two. We can choose not to read newspapers. But I do think that statutory element is important. There has to be that. We have to handle it with extreme care because of the game that I've talked about, the game with politicians and influence and all of those things. We don't want, as probably would have happened in Tony Blair's day, because he was so keen on putting his cronies everywhere, we don't want three friends of his running the kind of the organisation that looks at standards. We don't want three former politicians in that sense. We have to be very, very clear that it would be an independent body. But actually, BBC Trust seems to work perfectly well as an independent body. It seems to resist government pressure all the time. Obviously, there is a danger, but I think there is potentially a route through in terms of in terms of statutory responsibility. But I think the really important thing in all of this is that statutory responsibility, that statutory regulation, cannot be about regulating journalists. You have to regulate the newspapers. That's where the commercial part of these things is. You've got to regulate the newspapers, and leave the newspapers to regulate their own staff, to make their staff conform. And in terms of trying to sort out that regulation, think about ideas, think about codes of behaviour for journalists. They can be part of it, but they can be enforced by the newspaper, and then if the newspaper doesn't do it, then that becomes a matter for the public. Think about defining this public interest as against interest of the public line. Think about setting down some rules in that. I think that is all absolutely there. And the other thing, and this has nothing to do with regulation, whether we have statutory regulation or not, you have to deal with law breaking. phone hacking is breaking the law. And the most, I'm afraid, I do think journalists have been shown to be appalling in this, newspaper proprietors, newspaper editors to be appalling. But the other group who seem to be getting off relatively lightly at the moment, and again, the police station is opposite, it's the police. And so if the police are taking money to give stories to newspapers, that's bribery. If you or I tried to bribe a policeman, we'd be arrested. If he took the money or she took the money, they'd be arrested. It's straightforward law-breaking. And I find almost the most... I don't think any of us had any great illusions about how appallingly some newspapers acted. And I don't think journalists tend to be down there with estate agents and, you know, people we don't trust very much. But we all... You know, the basis of a democracy, the basis of the world that we live in is that we trust the police. And this is what's been revealed. And I think we really need to go much further in looking into that, and regulation won't get anywhere in that sense. I suppose the final thing we need to think about is our own complicity in all of this. I've admitted already I wanted to know who Andrew Marr had his affair with. I Googled it and found out. I sometimes go to petrol stations and I lean over to pick up the Independent or the Guardian or even the Daily Telegraph, and I see something. Actually, it gets worse when your eyesight goes, doesn't it? Because you have to find your glasses then to look at it casually. Who is that on the front of the Sun? We do all have a curiosity. And in many ways, that's the best thing about us, because we're not individuals, Margaret Thatcher. We are a society. We all do belong to a kind of body. And we're interested. We're interested in our neighbours in our village. We're interested in that sense. But there becomes a point where neighbourliness and interest in people tips over into nosiness and prying into people. People's lives. And I think it's reach of us to define that. If we could define that, if we could be clear about that, that might sort out our attitudes to the press and newspaper as well. So some ideas, some experiences there, and I've talked for too long, so I'm going to stop. Thank you for listening. If you've got questions, I'm very happy to answer the questions.
People who write comments underneath, and some of them are very good, actually, sometimes we read them. shouldn't just be a kind of mea culpa slot every time he says. And I sympathise with you in the sense of that kind of titillation and debating and corrupting of innocence. I think there's a great sense of corrupting of innocence and wanting to pull everyone, make everyone the same. But I want to, I'm just very nervous of saying that comes from the press. I think that comes from all sorts of areas. I think that the whole, you know, there's an industry out there wanting to corrupt kind of, you know, 12-year-old girls' kind of views of the world. So I think sometimes we're led, sometimes we're happily led, and sometimes we're complicit. I just think I'm just nervous of it being clear cut. So I'm probably just worried about that.
Over the course of your career, have you seen a trend towards more objectification? Seeing that through your faith eyes as well, that's actually kind of become a dominant role in society. And then on top of that, is the protection
driving
objectification?
What do you mean by that?
Well, seeing people as objects rather than as people.
I mean, I think quite the opposite, actually. I think the great mantra now about stories, it's where the news and comment things get run together, is news isn't interesting in and on its own merit. It has to be a human story. So the mantra of the Telegraph at the moment is all people want to read human stories. They want to read about other human beings. So they don't objectify them. They may caricature them, they may stereotype them, they may make them representative, but they're almost too fascinated by the human. I think if we could remain
spiritual, it's not good for the side of the human story that comes into noise.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think that's why I'm going to check it. So for example, you've got, you know, on one hand, reporting a story about human trafficking and what it's called, sort of sex slavery and all that. On the other hand, and you've got page 3, and you've got the X Factor, and you've got the hype around. I think this is, it's kind of weird to say that there's investigative journalism. There's also like the media, which is TV and the internet, and it's just like human story, human passive. But it's, it does sort of reflect society, but at the same time, most of society doesn't have the power of speech. And so there is, you get the press being concerned, as it were, but at the same time, there's a driving power of the press actually.
I think that's the, I didn't know what the answers, I didn't know if it's 60, 40, 40, 60, 50, 50, or all those things. Absolutely, I mean, the only thing I'd say about the press is, I mean, you know, you're all just here today as churches together, and you all come from different traditions, so within Christianity, well, we are probably all Christians, there are different forms of Christianity, which you know, the onlooker might find different forms more or less attractive. And I think newspapers are that, and The Tom Pilger example I used at the beginning in the Daily Mirror is an unusual one. And I'm afraid that the red tops that do have those pictures of women in them don't particularly tend to do investigative reporting. The Daily Mail absolutely doesn't do it. So, I mean, I think the kind of more sensible papers. What I worry about more, in a way, is the kind of what we used to call the broadsheet newspapers. They won't play that sort of, that kind of silly, titillating celebrity game. But they kind of report it, they then report it almost second-hand. So they sort of follow on if they try and distance themselves from it. But they've started reporting this as well because they've got this idea that you have to be part of this world in order to kind of sell copies. And I think that's a slightly worrying thing. I mean, just to pick out your question, what I meant to do, but obviously I ran the graphics far too long, but just to mention very briefly religion and the media trying to talk about people's religious beliefs and if people have a religious motivation for doing things. I think there's a real there's a great willingness to knock that clarity and misunderstand it, or if it explains things particularly well, just you know, ignore it altogether. It's just one of those awkward things that people rush forward. And I think one of the things that I find very interesting at the moment is this whole band, and I'm sure we've all seen them performing in public, people like Richard Dawkins, Daisy Grayling, these militant secularists, and I've been unfortunate enough to be on platforms with them. I mean, in a sense, they become fashionable, but the people rather like them. They may not particularly agree with them, but people rush to report them. And there's an unwillingness to challenge that particular view. something that they feel they absolutely have the answer with a capital A. And I'm not very good on answers with a capital A. I think there are lots of questions. I think faith is all about feeling your way towards answers. So they caricature religion as if it is the answer. And then they produce their own form of religion, which is their answer, which is the sort of apolitical religion. But did anyone listen to Charles Fraser, the canon chancellor of St. Paul's, with Richard Dawkins this morning?
Yeah.
It was just marvellous, because Richard Dawkins' argument was, you can't be a Christian, you can't name the first book of the New Testament. And he had all sorts of other ridiculous texts. And then Charles Fraser just said to him, so can you tell me the proper title of Darwin's Origin of Species? And he couldn't. He is a Darwinist, so he couldn't name it. So it was just a great moment when he couldn't do it. And then you're right, and I think...
Thank you.
judged and we sit on juries and judge them. So there's an element of judgment in being good citizens in all of that.
Perhaps
good
judgment.
Oh, sorry, yeah, sorry. Yes, there's an element of judgment. I mean, I think what the press does, and perhaps I'm as guilty of this as anyone else, is that if you're writing particularly about individuals, in a sense you have to have a view. And it's the blurring of news and comments all the time. Nothing can simply be reported and leave people to judge what they might think at the end of it all. That you actually have to you have to kind of come to a conclusion. People I even find when I try very hard not to be a sense of what I think in that, that there is. And partly that's because you get criticised if you seem a bit woolly. I mean, a good example I've been writing about this week is there's a series about to come up next week on BBC 4, a three-part series, just simply called Catholics. And three one-hour documentaries made by an observational documentary maker who was simply just filmed. One week he filmed the cemetery, one week seminary, sorry.
Virtually.
Seminary, one week in a children's school, and one week in Westminster Cathedral, which is meant to be about women in the church, which is a very odd way of doing it. And he just films. And there's no commentary. He doesn't tell you what to think. He doesn't lead. The things come up as they come up. And in that sense, you think, oh, that's it. That's what newspapers should be doing. Not imposing any judgment. Basically giving you a picture and saying, OK, you watch this programme, and at the end, put the kettle on, sit down, have a think about it. What did you make of it? Make your own judgments. But of course it doesn't work, does it? Because he spent 5 or 6 days in each of those places with his camera running, and he then has to cut it down to 60 minutes. So who decides which bits he cuts down? And he's made choices in that. He's left bits in, left and taken bits out. So there's, well, I think there is inevitably an element of judgment. And you're a doctor. You make a judgment in those things. I mean, touching at straws then, sorry, that wasn't good.
I mean, if they were outside casualty and they blew their legs off
the walls, I'd have to judge them. Yeah. As I would treat queen theory. Yeah. As I would treat anybody else. But I think newspapers are in the business of judgment to a certain extent. I think that's part of the business. And expecting them simply to be objective and to leave you to... I don't think people will buy newspapers if you just sort of said, look, here's all the arguments... And unfortunately, I apologise, but I've slightly done this evening where I said, look, here's one set of arguments why it's a virtue, here's one set of arguments why it's a vice. I mean, I've slightly come down on one side, but I think if newspapers simply gave you two sets of facts and said, read our newspaper and go off and have a think about it, no one would buy the newspaper, really. Or would they? Who would buy a newspaper that would buy that?
With the advent of the internet, newspapers are increasingly forced to become human. It's fabulous. Newspapers, because we can get news 24/7, we only see what 5 days a year, by phone or computers, and probably in the orders of New York Times. So the only place for newspapers to have is as a big former media. And I don't think my criticism of the news, I mean, of course you can get that journalism, but that's used to make value judgment. My big criticism of newspapers sometimes is that they don't follow up on stories, and they don't apologize for the truth, and I think particularly that when that kind of weird guy thinks, it's a crisis, something from, they put in the frame of the
murder. Oh, yeah, yeah. But he shouldn't be forced to. But the interesting thing that came out of that was the Attorney General is now this particular Attorney General is being very, very, very tough on newspapers that are prejudging and making it difficult for juries. Because one of the rights of the defendant is that the jury shouldn't come with any preconceived. preconceived notions. But I think the other point that you made, sorry, I feel stupid I didn't make it, it's a really, really important one, is that because of 24-hour news now, newspapers only come out once every 24 hours, I mean, basically the stories have all happened, and by the time you come out the next morning, what are you left to say? If you just regurgitate the facts again, I mean, certainly no one will read you. So you can either do it as a sort of, you can either think of another angle to take it from, or the quick and easy way is to express a view on it. And you know, and you're right, lots of those views are interesting. And I don't think we all supinely read the view and think, oh, well, that's the right view then, they've told me what to think. I think we all have our own thoughts in that sense. Judgment. We don't want to hear that you know, people who appear nice are nice.
Just reporting the fact, getting the comments out.
you to ask me another difficult question. Last question.
To wait, I've got to just go and help my wife.